Don't know about the applause. I'm going to start out with what might be a bit of a controversial statement. Bit of nervous laughter in a race, in a talk about racism, starting with controversial statements. Bit of a bold move. My controversial statement is this. I think it's possible to abolish racism. Now, if that sounds a bit fantastical to you, I don't blame you at all, because the reality that confronts us today is that we live in a deeply racist society. So let's start with Australia. Indigenous men continue to have, on average, a life expectancy that's almost a decade shorter than non-Indigenous men. 43% of Indigenous people have a weekly income of under $500 in a cost of living crisis. Despite being less than 3% of the population, Indigenous people make up 27% of the prison population. The number of Indigenous people behind bars has actually tripled over the past 20 years, with incarceration rates 12 times higher for Indigenous adults compared to non-Indigenous adults. And for youth, that figure is 22 times higher than their non-Indigenous counterparts. A few years ago, it was exposed that the New South Wales Police had maintained a secret watch list composed largely of Indigenous youth for over two decades. 48 Indigenous people have been murdered in police custody this year alone, and that's the current count is 549 Indigenous deaths in custody since the Royal Commission in 1991. And in that time, not a single police officer or prison officer has been convicted for any of these murders. Now, a similar dire picture confronts African Americans. In 2019, the median household income for African Americans was $23,000 compared to $184,000 for white Americans. This graph is from 2016. The United States also remains a deeply segregated society, with decades of racist housing policies carving up major cities. So these maps illustrate this divide, with the white population represented by red dots living in the wealthier areas of major cities, and black people represented by blue dots in the poorer outer suburbs. So here's Minneapolis, this is LA, this is Chicago, and this is New York. So this illustrates, I think, one thing about racism, that it goes just beyond the ideas. It's something that's deeply structured into how our society is organized. And of course, people would be familiar with the overrepresentation of black people in American prisons and amongst those murdered by the police. And now, a new hard-right conservative backlash in the US is trying to rewrite history by spreading the idea that slavery was good for black people because it taught them essential skills. Disgraceful. Then there's the situation for refugees and migrants. In June of this year, as governments and media outlets were pouring their energies into the search for five rich people in the Ocean Gate submarine, a few days earlier, more than 500 refugees were left to drown by Greek authorities in the Mediterranean. These brutal policies, now adopted around the world, were inspired by the anti-refugee policies of the Rudd Labour government back in 2013, which declared that no refugees would ever be allowed to call Australia home. Thousands who have fled war, poverty, and persecution have found themselves inside Australia's inhumane detention system, some spending many years of their lives or their entire childhoods being tortured and treated like criminals. Then there's also anti-Muslim racism, anti-Chinese racism, anti-African racism, the forms of racism that exist in the global south. It's enough to make your blood boil, and it absolutely should. Now, it'd be understandable to look at this snapshot of how deeply entrenched racism is in our society and feel pessimistic about any prospect that society could ever be different. So much of the common sense ideas about how to understand racism assumes that it's an eternal feature of human nature, an expression of some deeply rooted hostility to people who are somehow different from ourselves. And even the common sense ideas of anti-racism accept a version of this argument, often assuming that racism is the product of a conflict over resources and political power between white people and people of colour. The conclusion that people often draw from this, from these perspectives, is that racism can't ever be eradicated, but can only ever be minimalised through individual self-reflection, reform, and greater representation. Now, Marxists have a completely different argument to make. Racism is a product of capitalism. It serves the interests of the ruling class and is driven and shaped by their interests. And because racism is a product of capitalism, it's possible to end racism by overthrowing the system that creates and perpetuates it. So, let's start by looking at the kind of society that requires racism and why. So, at its core, capitalism is a system that's built on exploitation, where a tiny minority profits off the labor of the working class majority. Now, this minority of capitalists, which include people like Jeff Bezos, Elon Musk, and Gina Reinhart, own and control the means of production. And this is the productive wealth of society. The factories, the warehouses, the office buildings, the data centers, the mines, the tools, machinery, data, and raw materials. Control over the means of production also give the capitalists quite a lot of say over what gets produced in society, how it gets produced, as well as disproportionate political influence. Capitalists also don't work themselves to survive or make their corporate empires run. Jeff Bezos isn't picking packages at Amazon. He's not driving delivery trucks. Elon Musk isn't at the factory assembling Tesla cars or writing the codes at Twitter, and that's probably for the best. Instead, all the necessary work that makes the economy function is done by millions of workers all around the world. Those of us who have nothing to sell but our ability to work for a boss. Workers make new wealth, but we only get paid a portion of that as wages. The rest goes to our employer as profit. And if we can win a pay rise, that cuts into the boss's profits. But the more the bosses can get away with cutting our pay and cutting our conditions, or making us do the same or less for even less pay, sorry, or more for even less pay, the greater their profits at the end of the day. Competition with their rivals means that each capitalist is compelled to maximize their profits by squeezing their workers further. Because of this, capitalism is a constant tug between profits and wages, capitalists and workers. One side can't win without the other side losing. Because workers are the ones who are doing all the work that's required to make our workplaces and the economy function, the capitalists need the working class, but workers don't need capitalists. We have the power to go on strike and paralyze our workplaces, stopping the flow of profits to their bosses and putting pressure on them to give in to our demands. And this is what we're seeing today in Hollywood, with the production schedules of the big studios being brought to a halt by hundreds of thousands of writers and actors on strike. But that potential exists for workers to go even further than this. By shutting down production across the economy and restarting our workplaces under our own democratic control and overthrowing the capitalists and creating a society of workers' control. This is what we mean by socialism, where the workers who do all the work to make society function actually get to make the decisions about what that society looks like and what the wealth we produce is used for. So how does a minority of capitalists keep themselves in power over a majority who do all the work and who have every interest in overthrowing them? Good question, I hear you ask. Firstly, the capitalist control over production gives them the wealth and the ability to establish and maintain state institutions that physically enforce their rule. This includes a government bureaucracy and a parliament that manage the economy and their common interests, and a legal system and judiciary that enshrines and protects the rights of property owners. It also includes a police force and prison system that protects private property, disciplines the working class, punishes those who disobey the rules, and represses workers who threaten the ordinary functioning of businesses through protests and strikes. Secondly, the capitalist class control over production means that they also control the ideological institutions of society and shape the dominant ideas that we're all subjected to. The media is dominated by massive corporate empires whose owners have the same interests and worldview as the rest of the capitalist class. The education system is geared towards preparing people for their future lives as either bosses or workers, so it's shaped by the needs and interests of businesses, and they reinforce the ideological norms of capitalist society. These institutions uphold the view that capitalism is natural, that the market is good, that businesses have a right to make profit, that it's the opinions of the rich and powerful that matter, not those of ordinary people, that you should just focus on your individual life and your ambitions rather than trying to change the world, and that any attempt to change the world will only end in violence and suffering. Finally, the working class and specific sections within it are structurally oppressed and held down. And this is the product of the structure of capitalist society. Not owning the means of production means that workers are forced to purchase the necessities of life from those who do. In order to do this, we're forced to work and surrender our agency to our bosses for multiple hours a day, or risk starvation or homelessness. And that's the reality that most of the people in the world are subjected to. Our bosses decide what repetitive tasks we'll spend our workday doing, how we'll dress, what we can say and what we can't say, whether or not we can stand up to racist customers or not, even where we stand and what facial expressions we might use. Because we're seen as another input in the production process, capitalism turns human beings into human resources. Everything about our lives as workers is shaped by what we have to do to survive. From where we can afford to live, the kind of education and public services we have access to, the kind of food we can afford, to our health and life expectancy, our experience of the state and the legal system, to how much free time we have outside of work, and whether we can spend it doing what we want or whether we have to spend it preparing for the next workday. Following orders, being told how things are, not having any meaningful say over our own lives, lowering our expectations and generally feeling powerless and like we don't matter, all of this becomes normalized. The human beings that capitalism requires to function have to be ground down in order to then be exploited. But this experience, which is common to all working class people, gives us a common basis around which we can identify with each other. We can also have common interests such as higher wages, better conditions, greater democratic rights, and ultimately a world without capitalism around which we can unite and fight together. Capitalism needs to disrupt this potential unity and, where necessary, get us to be ambivalent to each other's suffering or even turn on each other. And this is why oppression on the basis of race, as well as gender and sexuality, are crucial to the operation of capitalism. So, racism serves three important functions for capitalism. Firstly, as a form of divide and rule. The working class has incredible potential power because we do all the work that's necessary to make the world function. Workers also need to resist collectively, whether that's protesting, going on strike, or making a revolution. So pitting working class people against each other is essential for capitalism to stop workers from uniting. This is done by making workers think that the real threat to their livelihoods are workers from other races, religions, or countries, not their own rulers. This can often look like blaming migrants for stealing jobs and drumming up racist hysterias against black people, refugees, Chinese people, or Muslims. Secondly, racism helps increase the profits of the capitalists by driving down wages and conditions. This is done by having sections of the working class who can be paid less through discriminatory practices, or having people in precarious situations who are then pressured into accepting lower rates of pay out of desperation. An example of this is companies hiring migrants or international students on lower rates of pay, and then using it as an argument to other workers to accept lower pay themselves or even undermine their own claims for higher pay or risk losing their jobs and being replaced by low-paid workers. And this doesn't just hurt the workers who are racially oppressed themselves, it also lowers the conditions for workers as a whole, including the workers who don't directly suffer from racism. Often the racist hysteria of migrants stealing jobs is a cover for bosses screwing over all workers. So racism actually is a distortion of what happens in the capitalist workplace. Thirdly, racism is a tool that's important for ideologically justifying particular projects of the capitalist state, including wars, borders, and state repression. How do you convince working class people to go and die in wars or to kill other working class people on the other side of the world? Through dehumanizing those who have to be invaded. Every war Australia has fought has been accompanied by racism against people from whatever country our government is at war with. Governments also use the fear of terrorism and crime by foreigners to militarize their borders and justify crackdowns on civil liberties. Now, these three functions of racism tell us a lot about it. Firstly, because racism is so important to the running of capitalism, it's why any party that wants to run a government becomes a perpetrator of racism. You have to be willing to wage wars, enforce borders, and justify state violence through racialized hysterias about crime and domestic security threats. You have to boost the profits of the economy through lowering labor costs and allowing destructive industries to operate on Indigenous land. This is both the case in the United States with the Republicans and the Democrats, and with both Liberal and Labor in Australia. Secondly, racism is not just about the ideas in people's heads, nor is it just about how individuals treat each other, although these are aspects of racism as well. It's first and foremost about how people are structurally oppressed by institutions of power in our society. It's about how you're treated by the government, by your employer, by the police and prisons, and by the media. Who has control over all these institutions and the decisions they make? It's not ordinary people, it's the capitalist class and the ruling class. Thirdly, this means that racism can't be fought and ended on an individual level through education or individual advancement of people of color or by their well-meaning allies trying to center their voices or buy from their businesses. You actually need to fight against the structures of power in our society. You have to fight the ruling class and force them to do things that are against their interests, and that can only be done collectively, not as individuals. Finally, it also shows what's wrong to think of racism as being about white privilege. This phrase, I think, is a really inaccurate and unhelpful way of understanding racism. racism, and every other form of oppression is about the capitalist class maintaining their privilege and supremacy over society. White privilege as a concept accepts that racism is a tug of war between white and non-white workers, rather than the rich screwing over all of us. Even though white workers don't personally experience racism, because it's used as a way to lower their conditions as well and weaken their collective, the collective power of the working class as a whole, they are also hurt by it and have every interest in fighting against it. And I'll return to this point a little bit later. Racism is itself a creation of capitalism. It didn't exist before capitalism. Now, prior to capitalism, there were other class-divided societies whose rulers engaged in wars against each other, they enslaved people to build their empires, and they had different forms of oppression to help them maintain control. But there weren't biological categories of race or social systems built around the idea that everyone of a particular skin color was inherently inferior. One example of this is Septimus Severus, who is the first black emperor of Rome, who ruled from 193 to 211 AD. Even the religious conflict between Muslims and Christians during the Crusades was not the same as racism, because you could convert out of your religion and no longer be oppressed. You can't convert out of your race. The rise of capitalism saw brutal colonial expansion as the new capitalist powers scrambled to carve up the world, its resources, and its people. Karl Marx described this process in the first volume of Capital, writing, "The discovery of gold and silver in America, the extirpation and enslavement and entombment in mines of the Aboriginal population, the beginning of the conquest and looting of the East Indies, the turning of Africa into a warren for the commercial hunting of black skins, signaled the rosy dawn of the capitalist era of production." Racism emerged out of the slave trade in the Americas, where capitalism was being built off cheap labor, growing crops such as sugar, tobacco, and of course, cotton. Initially, hundreds of thousands of white indentured servants, indentured laborers were used, but then were superseded by black labor when the price of African slaves fell and it became cheaper to use them instead. Now, initially, white and black laborers lived and worked together in fairly similar conditions, and they started to rise up together against the plantation owners. The first laws codifying differences based on skin color were introduced after a multiracial uprising in Virginia called Bacon's Rebellion in 1676. It was an attempt by the ruling class to prevent future united uprisings by creating real material differences in the rights and conditions of black and white laborers. After a century of increasing differences, the American Revolution took place under the slogan that all men are created equal. But if that was applied universally, it'd mean ending the slavery that the new capitalist economy was built on. By arguing that black people were subhuman and not deserving of these rights, slavery was preserved and capitalism was protected and racism had emerged fully formed. Now, what made racism a necessity under capitalism was capitalism's claim to be a society of individual freedom and formal equality. Prior societies didn't pretend to be founded on formal equality. Their social hierarchies were so explicit, and so it didn't need to come up with a new ideology to justify inequality. You know, God had just decided that the kings and queens could rule over everyone, and that's it, you just had to deal with that. Capitalism, however, had to square this circle, and to establish and maintain itself, racism was the solution to justify inequality in a society of supposed equality. In order for capitalism to be established in Australia, British invaders tried to eradicate Aboriginal societies because many of them refused to live according to the principles of profit accumulation and market competition. The brutal genocide was justified on the grounds that Aboriginal people were flora and fauna and that Australia was terra nullius. Control over land and how it was used by Australian capitalism is the foundation of racism against Aboriginal people. Throughout Australian history, the pastoral and mining industries have been some of the biggest opponents of Aboriginal land rights. Gina Rinehart's father, Lang Hancock, once advocated sterilising Indigenous people by poisoning their water supplies and getting them off their land. And just a few weeks ago, the West Australian State Labor Government revoked new heritage laws aimed to protect culturally significant Indigenous sites after concerted campaigning from the mining and agricultural sectors. Now, understanding the interests of the capitalist class as the driving force behind racism helps explain why in the United States, people with black skin had to be imported, while in Australia, there was a concerted attempt to wipe them out. This is because in one context, capitalists saw one group of black people as an essential source of labor, and in the other, they were seen as a barrier to establishing the system on a new continent. Racism has always been driven by the interests of the capitalist class, and it's why it persists today. The clearest illustration of this is seeing how the targets of racism shift based on the interests of the capitalist class in each country. People don't just suddenly, on a mass scale, develop hostility to people living amongst them completely out of nowhere. Yeah. Racism has to be whipped up. Yeah. So when the capitalists want to go to war, they have to whip up the corresponding racism to go with it. Anti-German and anti-Japanese racism was drummed up during World War II, anti-Asian racism during the Vietnam War, and anti-Muslim racism during the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, and now anti-Chinese racism is being ratcheted up again because of the growing economic and military tensions between Australia and the US on one side and China on the other. The targets of racism also shift to marginalize and hyper-exploit new waves of migrant labor. This also explains why racism is not just confined to Europe or countries with white rulers, but they're also used by non-white ruling class as well and figures amongst them. It's just as important as a tool of division and exploitation to the rulers of India, where Muslims and Africans are oppressed, Sri Lanka, where Tamils are oppressed, China, where Uyghurs are oppressed, Afghanistan, where Hazaras are oppressed, and so on and so on. The ruling class, regardless of their race, has an interest in defending their rule through division and oppression. This applies just as much to Narendra Modi, the Prime Minister of India, as it does to former presidents Barack Obama and current Vice President Kamala Harris. You can only understand racism in these contexts if you can grasp that it's a tool of capitalist rule, not a tool of white rule. Marxism is the only political framework that can properly explain why non-white ruling classes and individuals within them can also perpetuate racism. Now, what racism looks like over time has also changed in response to political developments and social struggle. After the Holocaust and the Civil Rights Movement, biological racism became largely discredited and confined to only the most fringe, far-right racists out there. Instead, racism was framed more in terms of culture, a violent culture, a culture of poverty, a culture that doesn't value education as much as others. You know, you've probably heard it all. The success of the civil rights movement also opened up new opportunities for a minority of people of color to rise through the ranks, and together with the ideas of neoliberalism and postmodernism, racism became less about structural oppression and more about individual discrimination and even about the individual choices of people of color. So today, corporations and governments are very happy to use diversity and representation to give themselves a progressive and even anti-racist gloss while continuing to exploit black and brown workers and continuing to destroy indigenous lands and communities. There's never been more representation for people of color in the halls of power, in media, in corporate boardrooms, yet life for the majority of people of color continues to deteriorate along with the rest of the working class. We have to reject the shallow tokenism and recognize that no matter how diverse the ruling class becomes, they remain the key beneficiaries of a system that requires and perpetuates racism. So racism is a product of capitalism. It serves the capitalist class who have the interest and power to constantly reproduce it through the various institutions of the system. Even the conditions that lead working class people to accept racist ideas are a product of capitalism. The system pits us against each other for the basics of life, even though we live in a world of vast wealth, and this normalizes rivalry and hostility within the working class, something that the ruling class then takes advantage of and uses it to stoke division amongst people of different races, religions, and nationalities. But if racism is the product of capitalism, not human nature, that means that the overthrow of capitalism can remove the structural basis of racism. The capitalist class needs to be deprived of their power so they no longer have the means to enforce racism, and that includes abolishing the police and prisons. Their wealth should be seized by workers and used democratically to improve the standards of living for everyone, removing the economic disparities caused by racism and removing the basis for competition and hostility amongst workers. In a society where capitalism is overthrown, where workers run the show, and there's nobody with the interest and power to drive racism, it can actually be abolished. Now, capitalism itself also creates the basis for racist ideas to be challenged and overcome. Though workers might be taught to be suspicious or hostile towards people of other races and religions, capitalism also requires a multiracial working class to work together in order to function. Having to work together, dealing with the same shitty conditions and the same asshole boss, workers can begin to identify with each other and their common interests, questioning some of their previously held backwards ideas. This process is accelerated when workers have to band together against a common enemy, such as their boss or the government. In the course of struggling collectively, workers have to unite to be successful, and that means challenging and transforming their own ideas. When faced with a common struggle against the ruling class, workers have to take up the demands and struggles of every marginalized group in order to be strengthened by their involvement in the movement. If the working class does not unite, it will lose. That is, there's no way getting around that. Karl Marx again summed up this when he wrote, "Labor in the white skin cannot emancipate itself where in the black skin it is branded." Capitalism creates racism, but the struggles it creates lays the basis for solidarity and working class unity, which makes overthrowing the system a possibility. And this is why the Black Lives Matter uprisings in 2020 drew not only millions of black participants, but millions more who were not black themselves. Yeah. This kind of solidarity is possible because most working class people don't actually benefit or have an interest in racism, so supporting Black Lives Matter isn't seen as a threat to their own livelihoods. People can be inspired by and identify with oppressed people standing up against power. In fact, workers who are more class conscious can recognize that the struggles against racism aren't just something to support, but are tied up with their own liberation. You can see this throughout Australian history, where when the working class has been in its most militant and radical, it's championed anti-racist causes. And this is one of my favorite photos of all time. It's from the union-organized Sydney May Day march in 1971, showing workers with banners championing the Indigenous land rights struggle, the struggle against South African apartheid, and the caption mentions that the march then became a protest against the Vietnam War. This is because when you recognize that the bosses are your enemies, then your fellow workers of all races are your allies, and if they are oppressed, every single member of the working class is held down. So you need to actively fight against their oppression. And this is what the politics of solidarity are all about, and it's what we need to rebuild today. So for socialists, fighting racism is not some secondary question or an added extra. It's essential to socialist politics. Precisely because racism is important, is an important tool for keeping the ruling class in power and the working class ground down, fighting it and weakening its impact is just as crucial for us. So we celebrate anti-racist struggles and throw ourselves into activism, whether that's helping to organize and build demonstrations against deaths in custody, or the struggle to free the refugees and fight every other form of oppression. Being a socialist means not having illusions in politicians, even those who are people of color. We see the power to change society lying in collective struggle in the streets and in the workplaces. And our responsibility today is to organize and to fight and to build the strength of our side in the fight against both racism and the system that creates it.